History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as it turns out, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. On our last episode, we got to know 99-year-old Jim Parker of North Las Vegas, Nevada, but it became clear that he had much more to say than we could fit into just one episode, and that if we wanted to hear the full story of his most remarkable mission, we were going to need more time. Well, that time is now, and I'm going to add up front here that photos of the B-17 he was piloting on December 19th, 1943 will really help you understand the severity of the situation even better. I have those posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also link to the first part of our conversation with Jim. His actions in the cockpit during the mission in question were recognized with the Distinguished Flying Cross, but he had never actually received the medal until decades later. Jim was surprised with it after donning his World War II uniform to participate in his grandson's commissioning as an Air Force officer.
I could still get in my old beige dress uniform. We get down there and I'm roaming around before the program starts, the graduation program. All these generals and colonels put my arm on their shoulder. I'm in uniform with Major. How you doing, son? I had every one of them so irritated me, they were about to kick me off of Maxwell Air Force Base. And finally, they called me, so I go down front, and the gal reads the citation. I'd never officially been awarded a Distinguished Flying Cross. So the female captain, she reads the citation, and I noticed every one of these ranking officers started looking. You know, what the hell's wrong with them? Anyway, I earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. I got everything shot out of the airplane, the controls. I didn't have aileron, rudder, elevator, no controls on it. I didn't have any electricity. I didn't have any oxygen, and yet I'm at altitude. And so it was up to me and God to get that damn airplane home with the crew. We made it home, and of course, we couldn't put the gear down. We didn't have any electric. So we knew we was going to belly in, and I told everybody to get comfortable wherever they were. The ball turret gunner had been injured, but they'd got him up in the radio room, so he was in a safe place. Come in. I swear I've never had the feeling another time in my life. I got to the threshold. I'm down there, and I'm right on stall speed. I told the co-pilot, I said, turn off the mag switches, which kills all four engines. Because there were four switches, but he could, with two hands, he could get them all at the same time. He hit those switches, and it just like we sat down. It wasn't like we landed. It just felt like we sat down. And I swear we didn't slide as far as across this room. And I was waiting for all the metal tearing and the dirt and finally winding up crossway somewhere. So God was really flying the airplane for me.
Well, I've got to hear that whole story. And the one thing I realized, you know, we've heard about your childhood and how you became a pilot and you going overseas. And I asked you about, you know, were you concerned you might not make it back? But the reality is you had to survive 53 combat missions to make it home to see your wife and your newborn son for the first time.
The story I like to tell is when you were over the target, the flak's flying and you know they're going to sic some fighters on you when you get off the target. You couldn't drive a straight pin up a pilot with a sledgehammer. He was puckering so tight. I think that's a pretty graphic definition.
It is.
But to fly an airplane, you got to be relaxed. The key is how quick you learn to be in this static condition and operate normally. It makes the rest of the world's problems look like they're whatever.
Well, yeah, so I want to understand some of this, and let's just start with that mission since you just talked about it. So you were given the Distinguished Flying Cross for bringing that plane and your crew in safely. Yeah. But where were you that day? Where were you flying? What happened to put your aircraft in that shape?
We were dropping bombs on Innsbruck, Austria, December 19th, 1943. Flak was heavy because this is a mountain town. Because anti-aircraft guns were closer to us, so they could be more accurate. And it was black going over the target from the exploding anti-aircraft. They peel off, and here comes this. I got the citation in there with 41 fighters. They hit me, and I can't stay in formation. So they got me for sure because I'm out of formation. I had the best gunners in the world. I said it before this happened, and I said it ever since. Every German that got a hit on us got two hits back. They shot down, I think they gave them credit for 16. We claimed 27 because they were all on us after they got us out of the crowd. That old airplane, it made a believer for sure of God because I didn't have any controls. So what could I do?
So I want everybody to understand how severe and how impossible this situation is. The fighters come. You've already gone through flak. Now the fighters, what made you drop out of formation?
My controls. They got my controls. I couldn't.
You cannot steer the airplane.
I can't. Yeah, I can't steer it. So I got power left. That's the only thing. I learned how to use power flying an airplane for 4 hours and belly it in, and everybody survived, didn't get a scratch in the belly landing.
But the enemy fire had severed some of the cables that would control?
All of the control cables. They got a lucky shot. I had to pay for it.
So how do you do that? How do you bring an airplane, a B-17, in safely when that happens?
Give it your best effort.
And meanwhile, your gunners are all trying to stave off these fighters. Because the odds are they're going to finish you off and shoot you down.
Yeah. The problem is, like I say, they started with 41 fighters. The first pass, we shot down 11. So the second time, it was 30, and we got a bunch then. They weren't doing their best fighting because my gunners were so deadly, it was unbelievable. Of course, they were in the airplane. They wanted it to get home, too.
And you said somebody was wounded?
The ball turret gunner before... He got out of the turret, got a 20-millimeter hit the turret, and it cut up his lower leg a little bit. The radio operator got him out of the turret and pulled him up into the radio room, and the first aid kit did what he could to stop the bleeding, mainly. It was 4 hours before we bedded in.
So that has to be the longest 4 hours of your life.
Oh, I thought of everything in the world during that period of time. I just realized the guy was co-pilot for me. I think it's the first time he had flown with me. He never said a single word from the time the fighters started till we got home and bellied in. But he was listening because I briefed him on the short final there. When we get to this point, turn those switches off. There, the power was instantly killed on the engine, so they couldn't start a fire or, you know, throw us around on the ground. All worked out good.
So you're 20,
21.
21 years old, and you not only are you hoping to go back and see your wife and meet a child who you've never met before, you're trying to make sure that the 10 guys on your plane get to go home to their families.
Yeah.
And you have no control. You can't steer the aircraft.
You've heard of loss feeling. That's the total loss feeling. 27,000 feet. You don't have any oxygen. You got to get down or you're going to die. You got no way to get it down. And we made it. I don't know how we stayed conscious, but I know the co-pilot was conscious all the time and functioning.
I mean, this is like every pilot's nightmare.
My solace was that I know God and he knows me and that he's going to get me home. So I just dealt with what I could deal with, and that was it.
I'm sure you're imagining all the different scenarios, right? I mean, you're 4 hours from where you need to be. You don't know if you're going to make it.
Yeah, see, the reason it took 4 hours, we were flying right at stall. Anytime I got 2 miles above stall, it'd start climbing, and I was trying to get it down.
Yeah.
So it was all power control.
What do you think would be the equivalent, maybe something that other people could identify with that they've experienced? I mean, is that like trying to drive a car with no brakes and no steering?
That's what it would be, a similar situation.
I mean, it kind of seems impossible.
It is.
But somehow
you got to have help, and God was there to help me.
What was being communicated within the plane during those 4 hours?
I bet there weren't five words said in those 4 hours.
Wow.
The top turret gunner, he was watching intensely. He wasn't up in his turret after the fighters left, and he wasn't asking any questions. He knew me, and I knew him. But he finally says, "Do you want me to go back and see what the damage is to the rear of the airplane?" I wasn't even thinking, and I said, "Sure, I really appreciate that." But his weight moving from the front to the back, if I'd have thought, it scared the hell out of me. But I never did think of it till after he got back. And it didn't say anything, but he said, "Ball turret gunner was injured. He's okay, he's in the radio room. Turret's a piece of junk. There's a gap torn out of the bottom of the airplane, so the tail gunner couldn't come forward. As part of his route wasn't there."
Yeah, just air.
And so he gave me that information, and that was the only thing I've ever said that whole flight.
So you lost control of the airplane as far as any kind of steering,
flaps,
or anything?
Standard controls, yeah. All the standard controls were gone.
And you lost your oxygen.
Right.
And you lost radio communication?
Oh, yeah, the radio was one of the first things to go.
And you guys?
That was the electrical system.
So the whole electrical system is gone.
Yeah. Landing gear, for example, it's driven by gear, but electric switch to electric motor. So I knew all the time if I got home with it, it's going to be a belly landing.
So there's no way to manually lower the landing gear?
There is, but we went back to manually lower it, and they would not turn. So something else was damaged in the system.
So this is one thing after another that you couldn't have possibly ever prepared for?
Well, yes and no. Be ready for anything. Cause I was always kidding the crew. Well, what's anything? Something you can't even imagine. Be ready for it. And I had a bunch of guys that we acted as one, whether we were communicating or not. We were always on the same page, and that's why we got 53 missions in and came home.
I know I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I've heard a lot of stories from a lot of pilots and a lot of crew members that flew a lot of bombing missions during World War II. And I don't think I've ever heard one quite like this, the scenario that you were in where somebody was actually able to bring the plane in safely. Was there a point where you considered having everybody bail out?
Yeah, just before we lost electric, I'd come on the interphone and stand by for bailout. I said, "I'll give you the bail." And, of course, when the electricity went out, the bail didn't work. So they stayed with me 4 hours knowing that to be ready to bail out.
What do you think would have happened to all of you if you had bailed out?
Well, one thing I know for sure, I would not have gotten out. The airplane would have gone stalled and gone into spin before I could have gotten out of my seat.
Because of the lost weight from all of them bailing out?
No, because the controls were gone. The cables were gone. The only thing I had in mind was keeping that dog level. You know, I didn't want to wing down and so keep it level and use my power to get myself down. The curiosity in my mind, of the 53 sorties, I'd say 40 of them, at least, I had an engine shot out somewhere. And I had two sorties where I had two engines out, one sortie where they were both on the same side. I was a pretty experienced combat pilot at the time that this one took place.
I guess.
The old picture is, I was flying A-20. I flew an A-20 in North Africa.
Right.
All of a sudden, I'm put on a B-17 crew. We report to a squadron, and they get the authority to keep the crew. The ops officer told me, he says, "I have you a crew. You're the pilot in command, and I got a co-pilot, bombardier, navigator, everybody, so don't worry about the co-pilot seat." When I got back that day, we had a short group commander, the 301st Bomb Group. And I'd seen him, but I'd never met him. And I'd just gotten out, and I was talking with the wing operations officer. He and I were personal friends. here he come up, and why in the hell did you land it off out there in the dirt instead of on the runway? I automatically pulled my 45 out of the holster and rammed the shell into it, and thank goodness that ops officer was bigger than me. Well, there'd have been holes in that commander, and I'd have been in prison the rest of my life.
He had no idea what you had been through.
It was an automatic reaction. He and I talked it over, and he said, you hadn't threatened anything.
But because your radio was out, nobody knows anything that's going on.
Nobody.
You can't communicate with anybody. There's nobody that can help you.
You can't ask for help. You can't get help. It's up to you. This is the moment when you're it, whether you want to be or not. You don't have a choice.
It's time for our first break, but we'll examine more elements of that December 19th, 1943 mission when we come back. If you want to see what that B-17 dynamite looked like after Jim Parker somehow got it back to base, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing our conversation with 99-year-old Jim Parker of North Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from McAllen, Texas. He's been telling us about a mission that earned him the Distinguished Flying Cross nearly 78 years ago, flying with the 301st Bomb Group's 32nd Squadron. His formation was jumped by German fighter planes, and while his gunners shot down quite a few of them, the damage inflicted by enemy fire was extensive. Before long, the bomber was without rudder or aileron or elevator control. He'd lost radio contact. In fact, the entire electrical system was out. His only way of directing the plane back to his base in Italy was through throttle adjustments on the B-17's four engines, which somehow had continued to function properly with fuel lines intact.
I mean, it took you 4 hours because you're flying at just above stall speed. How vulnerable was your plane for those 4 hours?
If an engine had gone out, we'd probably spun in. The gunners would have probably gotten out, but the navigating bombardier down in the nose, and in flight out of the nose was next to impossible because you're in front of all four engines.
And what about enemy fighters fire?
The fighters would only follow you, I'll say, 100 miles, and as far as they would go. They thought they had me shot down. In fact, German National Radio reported me by name, shot down.
Wow.
I get home, my group had me already reported as shot down. They were getting ready to call my wife when I got a hold of the 15th Air Force ops officer and don't let any false messages get out to my wife.
I'm just going to keep asking a lot of questions because this is so crazy, the story you're telling me here. So you're limping along. Number of things could have taken you out. As you said, you lose an engine, you're going to spin in, you're not going to have time to get the whole crew out. You even said there was no chance of you ever bailing out because by the time everybody else would have, you wouldn't be able to.
Right.
If the rest of your crew had bailed out at some point, would they have become prisoners of war, do you think?
Well, they said it bailed out in the first 30 minutes.
After that, you were back across the lines.
We were close enough to the conflict line. Italians were super American supporters. If you'd bailed out and you were still 300 miles short of the front lines. There would be Italian families that some way would camouflage you and get you down till you got back in American territory. You could say, well, they're stupid. In the second verse, you could say they're angels of God. That they were just lovable people.
And where was your base?
At that time, Cerignola, Italy. That's on the eastern part above Bari, between Bari and Foggia.
So you're trying to get all the way back to your base.
Yes.
And as this time is slowly ticking by, are you looking for alternate landing spots where you might be able to belly in?
No.
You're just thinking we're going to make it all the way.
I never had a single doubt in my mind from the time that we lost the controls that God was going to help me get the airplane home. It just, like I said, there wasn't any talking going on, so there wasn't any questions and answers. But all kinds of questions a couple, 3 hours after we got on the ground.
How did you maintain your course to make it back to base?
Power.
Just by the engines?
Yeah, just the engines. If I wanted to turn a little left, I'd pull the number one engine back till I got where I wanted. I'd bring it back and set it cruise. By the time I got on the ground, I was a perfectionist as power on that B-17.
Had you ever had to do that before?
No.
Had you ever even thought of that, that that was a possibility?
I thought of a lot of things. I never thought of exactly what happened. I never worried about would I be able to handle it. I worried about how I was going to handle it. The prime factor of crew success is a poker face pilot. It shows no emotion one way or the other. That feeds off to the next guy, to the next guy, to the next guy. I bet you I was asked by crew members in the next 30 minutes, how did you do it? What were you thinking? I went by their names, navigator, bombardier, co-pilot, top gunner, radio gunner, waist gunner, ball turret. I said, I sense God just let us all set foot on the ground. I was proud of my accomplishment, but I didn't really feel I'd done anything special. The title pilot implies an awful lot of things.
So because of the situation that your aircraft was in, the only way that you could make that plane go up or down or left or right was by changing the throttle on those four engines.
That's right.
So you're basically pulling levers for 4 hours trying to keep it straight and level and on course.
It's the easiest thing to do. I don't know where I have a picture of a throttle quadrant or not. They had the most unique throttle quadrant of any multi-engine airplane I ever flew. There were two bars come up out of the quadrant, and they come up about 6 inches, and you had a short bar at the bottom. Two and a half inches above, another crossbar, and then 2.5 above, another crossbar. The top one would only deal with 1 and 4 engine. The middle one had all four. The bottom one, inside engines, 2 and 3 engines. So you had unbelievable combinations you could work with power comfortably with a B-17. See, I flew a 36 which had 10 engines on it.
Yeah.
Of course, I only used 6. The co-pilot had the throttles for the 4 jets on the airplane.
That's a massive aircraft. I'm just fascinated by how you got this plane on the ground safely and saved everybody's life. You'd never done that before. Had you heard of any other pilots doing that?
Oh, I watched belly landing after belly landing.
But, I mean, in that condition where their only steering is the throttle.
Well, no, but that was just...
Isn't that a pretty big deal?
It's a big deal if you don't get excited.
Well, I guess.
All these things are new. Naturally, in airplanes, if you're just starting out, it's all new.
Yeah.
Everything that happens, you find a leveling bar in yourself. This keeps you level so that you're thinking clearly and smartly and accurately. I depend an awful lot on God, but he was there too.
So you get the plane on the ground finally. You belly land it. Nobody's injured other than your ball turret gunner who was shot up.
About a half mile on final, we shot a red flare, which let them know we had a wounded person aboard. So the ambulance crew knew that and just as soon as the airplane stopped, there they were out of the ambulance, and my radio man handed them ball turret gun.
Well, and the other thing, I'm trying to put myself in this and what you must have been dealing with, even on final, you're not sure how this is going to go, how hard you're going to come down.
Well, you've never done it before, so you learn it the first time right or you're hurt.
And even if your co-pilot hadn't been able to kill all four engines at once, that could have made things go haywire.
Well, if he'd got two and
the
other side.
So a lot of things could have gone wrong there.
Well, we discussed that at length for at least 30 seconds. Be sure, if you can't get them all four at once, don't touch any.
So what was the feeling that you experienced as soon as that plane was safely on the ground after 4 hours of what sounds like torture and chaos for a lot of people?
I wanted to see 9 warm bodies, and I never saw a crew get out of an airplane so fast in my life. Improbable manners. I went out, had a sliding side window. You couldn't get through it with a parachute on. About a half mile on final, I unbuckled my chute and got out of it. I noticed my co-pilot did after I did. So he was following the leader, so to speak. But that way, we were able to jump and get out through the side windows. I was on the ground before the dust settled. I went out the pilot's window, the ground, and there's all the crew. The old tail gunner, he couldn't come forward. And of course, it's opening there, so when we barely landed, scooping up dirt, dumping on him, it looked like a dirt man.
He was covered in it because it came up through the hole in the belly.
Dirt, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, was a tall guy. He was about 6'3", a Louisiana kid. I said, why don't you get out and push for me back there when we got slow? He said, I thought about it, but I couldn't get my feet against anything to push.
And then, but the first thing that happens to you is a guy comes to chew you out for not landing on the airstrip?
The group commander.
Yeah. And you instinctively pull your gun out before your buddy helps you out and saves you from doing something silly. Yeah. I mean, this is like the story
from the movie. That was an automatic reaction, just like everything I did in the airplane coming on.
And then after that, I'm sure you had a lot of explaining to do. Everybody wanted to know what happened, right?
No, my wing ops officer and I were good personal friends. You know, they debriefed every crew individually. But he wasn't satisfied with debriefings till he got mine. So he always debriefed me off every flight I took. And so we had a lot of personal conversations going back and forth there. And why did you think this? Why did you do that? I said, pointed each member of my crew. I said, there they all are, alive and walking. Nobody's limping. Nobody's crippled. Of course, the ball turret was in an ambulance going to the hospital. I said, here's your damned airplane. You can start stealing parts off of it now for you. Keep the other dogs running. I don't want to see it again in my life. There's a no man's land out there somewhere, and I was in that after I got out of the airplane. And this ops officer, knowing me as well as he did, he walked me off about 100 feet, and he said, you comfortable standing? I said, I'm very comfortable. And so I stood there with my arms folded, and he wouldn't let anybody come around and bother me or question me or anything. I finally gave him the high sign and walked over to where they were. And that was it.
And it's been 77, almost 78 years since that happened.
And I can remember every detail, everything that I did the whole way home.
And you've made that clear. But I'm curious if even after all that time, is it still hard to believe that that actually happened the way it happened?
Oh, yes.
Because you live in Las Vegas, the city of odds. People are putting odds on everything. What are the odds that given what you were facing, that eventual outcome would have happened?
Well, it's less than 1% probably.
Yeah.
But that's where true belief comes in.
You really didn't question whether or not it would end that way?
Nope. I never had the thought of crash landing out in the middle of nowhere. In fact, this ops officer, he knew me well enough. He says, when did you decide how you were going to do your landing? I said, about 20 minutes after I lost control of the airplane. I said, you got to plan ahead.
I guess so.
I said, I tell you what, next mission I get on, put you in the right seat and teach you what a combat sword is like. He made sure he didn't see me till after I finished up.
There's so many other things that come to mind here. Well, for one, I've talked to a lot of pilots and air crews who say one of the first things that happened after a mission like that, maybe not exactly like that because I haven't heard one exactly like that, but they would be offered a shot of whiskey.
Well, we were in the 15th Air Force. Everybody on the crew got a shot of whiskey. So I was the most popular guy in the wing because of the group because I didn't drink. Everybody wanted my shot of whiskey.
In fact, I heard you've never had a sip of alcohol in your life.
Never tasted it. I made an observation, I guess, 5 or 6 years old. That's when I first started dreaming flying airplanes. That old country farm boy needs all of his brain if he's going to fly an airplane. So don't muddle it up with alcohol. I've known some brilliant men, and I think about how much more brilliant they would have been if they'd left alcohol off the menu.
And another thing that came to mind about that DFC mission, did your crew have reunions after the war? Did you ever get together with those guys?
Never did. I stayed in contact by telephone. My radio man lives in some town there on the coast in Virginia. He was a perfect crew member. Like that ball turret got injured, and he was right back there, got him out of the turret and in the radio room. Otherwise, he'd hung on that turret and died.
The reason I asked about, you know, reunions or staying in touch is I just have to imagine that those guys were pretty amazed that you were able to bring that plane in the way you did. Did they ever say anything to you about that?
Oh, this, I'll pat me on the back.
Yeah.
I said, that's history. We got another flight. Let's worry about it.
And we should probably hear about some of those other flights before we bring this conversation in for a landing with 99-year-old Jim Parker. When we come back, more of his close calls in World War II, plus the clever line Jim dropped on Frank Sinatra, one of the many famous names he transported during his decades as a corporate pilot. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 99-year-old Jim Parker. We've heard all about the mission that earned him the Distinguished Flying Cross in December 1943, but he's not even sure that situation is the one that challenged him the most out of his 53 missions in World War II.
Is there anything else about those 53 missions that you're particularly proud of or you think is noteworthy?
I had about three interesting ones. We were stationed right out of Tunis in Tunisia, on Athens, Greece. We were on the bomb run. The flak was what it was supposed to be, moderate to heavy. You could hear the pieces hit the airplane every now and then. Just as my last bomb, you had a light in the cockpit as the bomb's released. Last bomb released, I thought I saw something move. I looked over number four engine, all pressure zero. So I fatted it real quick, and I saw another flip. I looked. Number three engine, all pressure, feathered it. So right on the end of the bomb run at Athens, Greece, I lose two engines on the same side. And this was a heavy airplane. I was one of only about three pilots that ever got it over the target. It just using too much fuel, and I knew they wasn't going to make it home. So we had an order that you safety first and bomb second. Don't tell the 15th Air Force. Anyway, I knew I wasn't going to get back to Tunis. That was it. We had a different navigator that day. Oh boy, weighed nearly 300 pounds. We'd thrown out all the ammunition after we got clear of where fighters would be. And then I started telling the gunners to throw out the guns. And I said, now some of you come up front and we'll dump the navigator.
I bet he didn't appreciate that.
Oh, he was scared. He was a young guy, but boy, was he big. So I had seen the Ski Airmen's fighter strip. They were flying P-40s at that particular time.
The Tuskegee Airmen.
In Sicily. Uh-huh. I told my co-pilot, I said, we're landing on that 99th runway at Sicily because we're not going to make it to Tunis. So we come in there and land, and the old colonel that ran the outfit, what the hell are you doing landing on my runway? I said, I didn't know it was your runway, colonel. He says, I run this airport. I said, it's in Sicily. That's part of Italy as far as I'm concerned. And they didn't tell me I couldn't land here. Oh, he was red hot. He went to get some of his younger pilots. He figured they could deal with me better. And I said, top gunner was also top turret gunner was expert mechanic, and so he gets out on four, and it was obvious it shot the head off a cylinder. So we go to three. They'd cut the oil line hose on it, so all we needed was a hose, and he had that in stock. So that fixed number three. I said, "Have you got any thin plate material, metal plate material?" And gasket material. He got his hand that knew where everything was. And so here he had me a sheet of gasket material and pretty good sized piece of tin. Couldn't be aluminum because it's too soft. We took the cylinder off, and then we took the piston out, and we disconnected it from the master. I said, okay, I had to get some, well, we had the nuts and the bolts. Get holes drilled in that plate to go down on it. We screwed that down good and tight, so I've got one engine with one cylinder missing. So get out, and believe it or not, I think they did all that in about 20 minutes.
Wow.
Everybody was in on the job, his people and mine. And so he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to take off and go back to Tunis. You better not start that four engine with that cylinder off. I said, well, you can watch from the side. So started the three, and I run them up, and they were all real good. And I waved to them, and I started taxing out. And then on the way out, I started number four. I get the other runway, and I give all four of them a go. And God, it was shaking like hell over there. I don't think I got 50 feet in the air until I feathered that four. But I'm in the air with three engines and the gear up, and we made it back to Tunis. That was probably the only time in my life that I had an urgency in the takeoff. I'm
not sure that you're going to get off.
Yeah. A concern, I guess, is a better word. But it's a profession that requires all of your attention. But it's so much fun that that seems like it's pleasant, not unpleasant. I give it credit for me getting to the age I am.
Sure.
I have all these stories to go back to. Whatever my mood is, I'll pick one that the other side of the mood, and I'm back on track.
You have how many flight hours in your career?
23,000 hours.
23,000 hours in a whole lot of different airplanes.
I have pictures in there. In fact, I can show you of every airplane I flew.
How long is that list?
22.
If you were a passenger and they needed somebody to hop in the pilot seat.
I fly anything, anytime, anywhere if need be.
I'm not surprised to hear you say that. And I understand in your career as a corporate pilot, you flew a few famous names, huh? You had some well-known passengers on your plane?
Well, Frank Sinatra was a good buddy of mine.
Yeah.
Arnold Palmer.
Uh-huh.
Senator Strom Thurmond. John Connally, governor of Texas for 3, 4, 5, 6 years.
I'm sure you have a good Frank Sinatra story.
Oh, I went to work for Martin Aviation in Orange County Airport, and they had a contract with him. They briefed me for 2 hours how to act, talk, and all when I picked up Sinatra. I said, well, how about these other people? They don't make any difference. But he was a fun guy to talk with. Finally, one day he says, do you like my autograph? And I said, no. And he looked kind of surprised. I looked at him and I said, well, can I change my mind? Oh, sure, big grin on his face. I said, okay, you got a blank check on the account that's just loaded with money? Sign on the signature line and I'll have your autograph. He cracked up. He looked at me and said, hell, you don't want my autograph. I said, it's your damn name. You do what you want to with it. I said, if you'd asked me for mine, I wouldn't have given it to you. He says, I believe you. We had a lot of fun together picking at each other. I tried to give everybody the safest, smoothest ride that was physically possible.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the guy that got it. He saw how I paid attention to every detail. But he was the passenger I had that I enjoyed the most.
I'm sure there's tons more stories.
I don't have a lot of horror stories. They might have been to some people. But my two great fears, we flew the 52s at 45,000 feet. And you got about 3 seconds life if the oxygen fails.
Yeah.
And getting the 52 down out of that. I had it all figured out. The first thing I do is chop the throttles and I hit the spoilers. And the spoilers slow the nose down and keep it from going too fast. And you'd come to maybe before you got down.
You'd hope.
If you passed out.
I'm glad you never had to find out.
I never did. But
well, on that topic, if you flew 22 different aircraft, is there one that in your mind was your favorite?
Learjet.
Yeah.
Learjet, to me, was like putting on your best fitting, comfortable pair of pants every morning. I closed the door on that airplane. I was in control. I had an experience. My second tanker was short of fuel, so he wouldn't give me an normal offload. Now, the 52, you don't know this, and I'm not telling you this. Every flight we had 4 nuclear bombs. Each one of them was capable of wiping out any city in the world. So we were not only up there flying 24 hours, we had targets and we had bombs. The old 52, God, what an airplane.
I think that's something that maybe we don't talk about enough, because we can talk about your 53 missions in World War II, and we know those are things that happened. With the B-52, as much as prolific as that aircraft has been and continues to be,
right.
The thing that always captivates me is what didn't happen. But you guys were up there, as you said, keeping those bombers flying 24 hours a day to really deter nuclear war.
Russia knew exactly what we had.
Yeah.
And they knew that we could be on target before they could do a damn thing about it.
And did you go through that in your mind? What?
Well, I went through the ritual of a prayer, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Ask God, don't blow the whistle today. The old 36, I flew the last one of those that ever flew.
Really?
I flew one from the Tucson storage area to Wright Field. The Air Force got funding for a new museum.
Yeah.
It was just about the time we phased out the Biggs there. It had the last wing of 36s operationally. I guess the Pentagon. Somebody called my wing commander in El Paso. Said, we know that you phased out all your 36s, but do you have a pilot that you would recommend that would fly one from the boneyard up here to Wright Field? He and I were buddies. What time do you want him to pick up the airplane? 2 days later, we were over in Tucson, pre-flighting this old dog. And I said, we're going to save you from the wolves here. We're going to get you out of the aluminum graveyard here and take you to a smaller one. You ever go to the Air Force Museum, that old 36 sitting in the middle of it? I flew it in there. May 29th, 1959, from Tucson Boneyard to Wright Field.
I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who have been to the Air Force Museum there in Dayton, Ohio, and they've seen that B-36. It's hard to miss. It's the biggest plane there.
230-foot wingspan.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country.
Well, don't worry about that.
And thank you for telling a story that only you could tell us. I'm curious, is there something at 99-plus years old that as you look back over everything we've talked about today and the rest of your life, is there something that you'd say you are most proud of?
Oh, I the old 17, I probably, if it's not number one, it's number two, getting that totally crippled airplane back home and nobody getting hurt. But I know I didn't do it. I know God did it and gave me credit for it. But the old 36, it took off and it just flew forever. I think my longest flight was 32 hours from Guam to El Paso. We took off 10 o'clock at night. They had a moderate rainstorm going there on Guam. And I started to bark and wait because I knew it's a shower, so it's going to move on. And flight engineer finished his run up, and they said everything was perfect. So I released the brakes, and away I go. We get in the air and get the gear up, and then when we flew over the edge of the island, it's a pretty good-sized cliff on the west east side. It felt a little bump. And then we broke out, top of the weather, at about 8,000 feet. And never saw a cloud from then to El Paso. 32 hours, and we flew out that night. We flew all day the next day, all night the next night, and landed Biggs at about 8:30, I think, in the morning. And all in 32 hours.
Boy.
Of course, we were the other side of the international dateline.
Yeah.
And I told her, finance officer, he says, well, I don't know how the hell to figure this per diem. I said, well, just think about all that hours we had to sit in that airplane. Well, I'll just give them another hour.
There are a lot of pilots that listen to this program, guys that maybe flew in the service or are flying now or learning to fly. I have a nephew who's in basic at the Air Force Academy right now who wants to be a pilot. What advice would you have? What's the most important thing you think pilots or would-be pilots need to remember?
Be ready for anything. You can get a million words, but that's it. Be ready for anything.
Words of wisdom for pilots and for the rest of us. That's Jim Parker, 99 years old. Don't forget to visit hometownheroesradio.com for photos, videos, and a link to the first part of Jim's story if you missed that last time. That is all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.